Scott here with another episode of the History Unplugged podcast. One person's hallucination can be easily dismissed, but what happens when an entire crowd has the same hallucination or suffers from the same mental illness? It's enough to make somebody believe in magic and pick up their pitchfork, ready to hang an accused witch. Now, such mass delusions have led to witch hunts in the past. In today's episode from the archives, we look at some of the most notorious historical cases of mass hysteria and moral panics. But these cases don't only extend to Puritan-style witch hunts, we'll also look at cases that hit closer to home, like economic bubbles that led to the housing market crash of the early 2000s, which in many ways mirrored the Dutch tulip bubble of the 1630s. Other historical moral panics include dancing mania, in which German peasants in 1374 spent weeks dancing in a fugue state, with some toppling over dead from utter exhaustion. We'll also look at the cat nuns in medieval France, where the sisters began to inexplicably meow together, leaving the surrounding community perplexed. We'll also look at the Jersey Devil Panic, in which dozens of newspapers claimed in 1909 that a winged creature attacked the trolley car in Haddon Heights. Hope you enjoy this episode. And one more thing before we get started with this episode, a quick break for a word from our sponsors.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
In the year 1374, a very strange event happened in dozens of medieval towns along the Rhine River Valley, and it was described by dozens of physicians, chroniclers, monks, priests, and even municipal orders trying to stop this event that was described by authorities. Hundreds of people suddenly got the compulsion to dance. They scarcely paused to eat or rest and danced for hours or even days on end. Within weeks, the dancing mania engulfed large areas of northeastern France and the Netherlands, and it only stopped after several months. The same event happened again in the city of Strasbourg in 1518. About 400 men, women, and children participated, and there were dozens of people who died, whether due to exhaustion or dehydration. In between these two dancing events, another strange event happened in the Spanish Netherlands in a nunnery. This happened in 1491 as cases for trials of witchcraft began to increase, and several nuns were declared possessed, which caused them to race around like dogs, jump out of trees, pretending to be birds, or meow and claw their way up tree trunks like cats. According to the records we have of this period, other people behave like this, but it was nuns who were disproportionately affected. And over the next 200 years, in nunneries all over Western Europe, hundreds were plunged into states of delirium, where they screamed and convulsed and confessed to having carnal relations with devils. We have all these documents that attest to these things happening, including trial documents in the archives of Inquisition records, or church trials for heresy. We have copious in-depth accounts and testimonies of nuns doing some very strange things. So what was going on here? What caused dozens of people or even hundreds of people to dance nonstop for weeks or months on end, to act like animals, and to claim possession? There's been all sorts of suggestions for why these things happened. In the early centuries, at the end of the Middle Ages or the beginning of the Renaissance, the easiest explanation was actually some form of possession. But even at the time, there were contemporary observers who thought that there was some sort of sickness. They could have been divinely afflicted, but it could have been a natural affliction as well, a sort of garden variety madness. In more recent decades, many have turned to a biological explanation. Maybe they ingested a mold containing psychotropic chemicals that caused them to hallucinate. But more recently, scholars have turned to the field of psychology and anthropology to argue that the dancing plagues and possession epidemics were classic instances of mass psychogenic illness, or crowd psychology. I'm going to be talking about mass delusion in this episode, events where this happened, possible explanations, and how people of the time and historians of today have tried to interpret these events. This has to do with a question that comes from Bill Frezza. Bill is a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, the membership program of History Unplugged, And as such, he can ask me questions about history and I will do my best to answer them. So what Bill asks me is to talk about the history of moral panics, from the Salem witch hunt to the Fells Acre daycare satanic child abuse inquisition. And I had a question from another listener who asked me about the Puritans as well and the Salem witch trials. And he says this: most of the writings about New England during the 1600s revolve around the Puritans. It concludes with the Salem witch trials and then nothing after. It's almost as if after the Puritans disappear. I can't find anything about the Puritans in the 1700s or beyond. What happened? My theory is that in the 1700s, with more people, that meant less of them by percentage were Puritans, so less coverage was given to them. Also, with more events happening in the 1700s, the less interesting Puritans went from less coverage to no coverage. So I'm going to lump that question about the Puritans into the first one about mass delusions and mass psychology, because as the listener hints in his own question, he kind of answers it, where the Puritans in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, once we get into the 18th century, proportionately, they're less and less a percentage of New England, and they don't have as much impact as they did before, even though Puritan religious culture still stays very strong in New England for centuries to come. But let's get back to this question about mass hallucination in history. First, I wanted to touch on these events in question, the 1374 dancing outbreak and nuns who claim to be possessed, talk about them a little bit. Then I'm going to get into psychology a little bit more and look at different psychological theories that explain how mass delusions can take place. Then we're going to look in more detail at the most notorious case of mass delusion, and that was the Salem witch trial, and how it bears resemblance to similar events that happen today. Finally, we'll see that in history, mass delusion wasn't just exotic events like a huge dancing outbreak, but we could also tie into more mainstream events, like economic bubbles, such as the tulip bubble in the Netherlands in the 1600s, where tulips were outrageously priced, and it was one of the worst economic bubbles in history. Now today, we see similar economic bubbles happening in economics, so you or I, or the general population, isn't as immune to these types of mass delusions as we might think, even though we might not spend weeks or months dancing to complete exhaustion. Well, first, let's circle back to an explanation to these outbreaks, such as the dancing outbreak. Beyond these people possibly ingesting psychotropic mold, one clue to the cause of these events is that they appear to involve dissociative trance. This is a condition that involves, among other things, a loss of self-control. It'd be hard to imagine people dancing for days on end when their feet are getting bloodied, except if they were in an altered state of consciousness. But eyewitness accounts of these dancers state that they weren't fully conscious. Onlookers describe them as being wild, frenzied, and seeing visions. One person noted that while they danced, their minds were no longer clear, and another person described them as having wearied themselves for dancing and jumping, they went raging like beasts over the land. The hundreds of nuns who claimed to be possessed were described in chronicles and legal records as also being subject to dissociative trance. So how do we explain these epidemics of dissociation? Again, some people say that the nuns might have eaten bread made from contaminated flour and ingested psychotropic mold, but this probably wouldn't have caused dancing to go on for weeks or months. Rather, there's strong indication that certain communities are unusually prone to epidemic possession. And they might have been more prone to psychological stress, and there's a good connection between psychological stress and dissociation. And this correlation could have led to mass psychogenic illness. So here's one interpretation of the dancing epidemic of 1374. Keep in mind, this takes place in a very rough century in Europe. This is right on the heels of the Black Plague, and in the Rhine River Valley, there was terrible flooding that had just taken place. Chronicles talk about the Rhine River rising 34 feet and floodwaters pouring over town walls and homes and marketplaces being submerged. You see decomposing livestock in the streets. And similarly, in 1518, in the decades before that dancing plague, there was famine, sickness, the medieval cold period, unusually cold weather, which created unusual hardship in Strasbourg. Bread prices reached their highest levels in a generation due to bad harvests. There were thousands of starving farmers and vine growers. and new outbreaks of the plague and in the early 1500s. You now had syphilis that arrived from the New World and was causing all sorts of problems in Europe. So these difficulties could explain some of the dancing outbreak in the 1300s and 1500s. But what about all the cases of nuns acting erratically? Well, nunneries weren't a place of just quiet contemplation and quiet prayer before God. Some nuns probably experienced that. But in the late medieval and early modern period, other nunneries could have been bad psychological environments. Some sisters didn't join a nunnery on their own volition, but maybe their parents wished that they joined or forced them to join, whether due to economic hardship or they thought that a nunnery would tame an unruly daughter rather than any sort of piety on their part. Once inside and once you took your holy orders, it was very difficult to get out. And this feeling of inadequacy for not living up to holy orders could have been psychologically devastating for some. One notable example is that of Jeanne d'Agenais, the mother superior of a Loudun nunnery in southern France, and she became infatuated with the local priest, Father Grandier, in 1627. She confessed, "When I did not see him, I burned with desire for him." In consequence, Jeanne felt overwhelmed with guilt. After weeks of penance and introspection, she fell into a dissociative state in which she repeatedly accused Grandier of plotting with Satan to make her lust after him. As a mother superior, she was influential, and this could have affected several other nuns, because within days, many more followed suit, and they also blamed the priest. After an investigation from the Inquisition, Grandier was declared guilty and burned alive. There's a lot we don't know about this case, but there's a collective psychology also in operation here. The one theory on why these cases pop so much from the 14th century to the 17th or 18th century is that people are more likely to experience a dissociative trance if they already believe in the possibility of spiritual possession rather than something like this happening in a vacuum. It means that minds can be prepared to shift into altered states if it's taught that these sort of altered states can happen. The anthropologist Erica Bourgeonone wrote about an environment of belief in the 90s, a set of ideas about the spirit world that members of communities absorbed that prepared them to achieve the possession state. So the dancers of 1374 and 1518 occupied an environment of belief that accepted the possibility of a divine curse or possession or bewitchment. So their metaphysical beliefs made it possible for them to enter the state and to have others affected by the state. So the dancing plagues were reliant on a belief system in communities where there was a pre-existing belief in the possibility of something like a dancing curse happening. Amongst the dancers in 1374, many believed that Satan had unleashed an irresistible dance, but they also begged for divine intercession and went to holy sites and submitted to exorcism. The people of Strasbourg in 1518 were convinced that a saint called Vitus had unleashed a dancing curse, and once they entered the possession state, it seemed they acted in accordance with the conventions of the Saint Vitus myth, dancing for days on end, and the dance turned epidemic because each new victim who joined this huge dance lent further credibility to belief that something supernatural was happening. What's interesting is that nearly all possession epidemics occurred within a 300-year period from around 1400 to the 1700s. This is a period where religious writers insisted that such events were possible, and theologians, inquisitors, and exorcists established the rules of mass demonic possession to which dissociating nuns unconsciously confirmed. Doing things like writhing, foaming, convulsing, speaking in tongues, and making obscene gestures. So they're acting out stereotypical performances based on deep-seated beliefs. And in this podcast, I've talked about how there's a myth about witch burnings that they happened all throughout the Middle Ages, but really, you don't see widespread belief in witches happening until really the end of the Middle Ages, but not even the Middle Ages, more like the early modern period, especially during warfare and battle between Protestants and Catholics in the 16th and 17th centuries. A lot of medieval scholars tried to teach peasants that witches didn't exist. They believed in magic, they believed in the supernatural, but not in witches. So in the 1100s and 1200s, you don't have people who think that they're being possessed or they could be tempted into witchcraft because it's taught by authorities that this doesn't happen. But when authorities are charging people with witchcraft in the 14, 15, 1600s, when there are fault lines between Protestantism and Catholicism, then you do see the outbreak of a lot more people believing these things to be true. And this is the time period in Puritan America when the Salem witch trials are happening, well after the Middle Ages, nearly into the Age of the Enlightenment, when one of the most notorious witch trials happens. Now, one book from the 19th century interprets the Dancing Plague, and has an interesting interpretation, and I want to mention it here. This book is by J.F.C. Hecker, entitled The Epidemics of the Middle Ages, and it came out in 1859. And he thinks that the dancing epidemic is somehow connected to Europe's pre-Christian past, and there's a thread from the pagan era going all the way up into the 1400s that might explain what's happening. Here's what he says. He thinks that the dancing mania has to do with the celebration of St. John's Day, or a feast day for St. John the Baptist. He thinks that this festival has a connection to Europe's pre-Christian past. Here's what he says. The manner in which John the Baptist was worshipped afforded an important and very evident cause for its development, meaning the dancing mania of the 14th century. From the remotest period, perhaps even so far back as the 4th century, St. John's Day was solemnized with all sorts of strange and rude customs, of which the originally mystical meaning was variously disfigured among different nations by superadded relics of heathenism. Thus the Germans transferred to the festival of St. John's Day an ancient heathen usage, the kindling of the Nodfire, which was forbidden them by St. Boniface, and the belief subsists even to the present day that people and animals that have leaped through these flames or their smoke are protected for a whole year from fevers and other diseases, as if by a kind of baptism by fire. Bacchanalian dances, which have originated in similar causes among all the rude nations of the earth, and the wild extravagances of a heated imagination, were the constant accompaniments of this half-heathen, half-Christian festival. At the period of which we are treating, however, the Germans were not the only people who gave way to the ebullitions of fanaticism in keeping the festival of St. John the Baptist. Similar customs were also to be found among the nations of Southern Europe and of Asia, and it is more than probable that the Greeks transferred to the festival of John the Baptist, who is also held in high esteem among the Mohammedans, a part of their Bacchanalian mysteries, an absurdity of a kind, which is but too frequently met with in human affairs. How far remembrance of the history of St. John's death may have had an influence on this occasion, we would leave learned theologians to decide. It is only of importance here to add that in Abyssinia, which is modern-day Ethiopia, a country entirely separated from Europe, where Christianity has maintained itself in its primeval simplicity against Mohammedanism, John is to this day worshipped as protecting saints of those who are attacked with the dancing malady. These fragments of the domination of mysticism and superstition, historical connection is not to be found. Okay, so this book is charming in its own way. It's written in the 19th century with the very beginnings of anthropology and ethnography. I've seen a few of these books from the 19th century. And to their credit, these researchers are trying to understand human tradition away from official church narratives or official history. But because of that, sometimes they go too far in the opposite direction, where they see a pre-Christian or pagan or Roman tradition kept alive in the folk population. Scratch a peasant and you'll find a still beating heart of paganism buried underneath that's somehow been maintained for 1500 or 1800 years. So they can go a little bit too far in that opposite interpretation. But hey, it takes a long time to build up a field, so you can't criticize these people too much. Before we get into the Salem witch trials, there's a more contemporary book that tries to explain social delusion and mass psychogenic illness. And it has more contemporary explanations. This book is called Little Green Men, Meowing Nuns, and Headhunting Panics by Robert Bartholomew. So he notes that what we call mass hysteria can also be known by such labels as epidemic hysteria, contagious hysteria, and mass psychogenic illness. To break it down a little bit more, British psychiatrist Simon Wesley identified two types affecting groups, anxiety hysteria and motor hysteria. So anxiety hysteria, which we haven't really seen in these cases that I described, has a rapid onset and recovery time, and it usually lasts just a day. And it's triggered by a perception of a threatening agent, usually a strange odor or rumor of tainted food. Symptoms include headaches, dizziness, nausea. So the symptoms result from an overwhelming stress reaction to sudden anxiety. Under rare circumstances, anxiety hysteria can spread to communities. This usually appears within cohesive, enclosed social units, like a nunnery or a Puritan community of Salem, Massachusetts. But the imaginary harmful agent is at large within the community in question, and anyone is viewed as a potential victim. So some episodes have involved rumors of the use of poison gas against ethnic minorities who distrust distant central governments, including the Palestinian fear of the Israelis or Soviet Georgian suspicion of Moscow. Mass motor hysteria develops more slowly than anxiety hysteria. It occurs in an atmosphere of accumulating long-term stress, group stress. It could occur in tightly controlled social situations like strict school or religious settings where discipline is extreme, and symptoms include trance-like states, melodramatic acts of rebellion, where pent-up anxiety builds over a long period of time, resulting in disruptions to nerves or neurons, sending messages to the muscles and triggering bouts of twitching, spasms, and shaking. So these symptoms appear gradually and usually take weeks or months to subside. One episode of motor hysteria occurred over several months in 1972 in a Canadian community where most people were of Aboriginal descent. They were descended from Cree and Ojibwe tribal groups. Psychiatrists who went to the village interviewed 13 residents between the ages of 11 and 18, and they noticed the life was very dreary. They typically complained of fatigue, irritability, headaches, and nightmares prior to having hysterical fits during which they'd try to run into the woods. This coincided with their anger and depression over cultural isolation in the village, where they lived under strict discipline, scant privacy, and prearranged marriages. In this case, a traditional society was undergoing rapid social change, which placed extraordinary stress on certain groups that were low in the power hierarchy. So, based on most contemporary psychology literature, most epidemic hysteria episodes occur within closed, tightly knit social settings, such as schools, factories, convents, and hospitals. There have been several reports of events that were labeled as community-wide, but mass hysterias in the social science literature of the 20th century usually don't involve the spread of hysterical conversion and anxiety. And there's plenty of historical examples of group delusions, many which can seem humorous to those outside of the cultural setting. In Leeds, England in 1806, residents became terror-stricken that the end of the world was about to happen, when a hen began laying eggs with the inscription, "Christ is coming." Masses gathered to look at the bird until they discovered that the eggs had been inscribed with the corrosive ink and forced back into the hen's body. Unfortunately, we have plenty of other collective delusions that are more sinister, such as racial persecution under Nazis, mass suicide in religious cults, witch hunts, scares of communist infiltration, and other activities that happen in cults. One of the biggest results of mass hysteria has to do with immediate community threats. This includes exaggerated feelings of danger within communities when members of the affected population are concerned over what is believed to be an immediate personal danger. Episodes usually persist from a few weeks to several months, and participants may express excitement and concern. An example of an immediate community threat occurred in New Jersey in 1909. Since at least the early 1700s, there had been stories of bizarre creatures in the desolate Pine Barrens region of central and southern New Jersey. There were sightings of what people called the Jersey Devil until the turn of the 20th century, when there weren't sightings reported and this faded into folklore. But between January 16th and January 23rd, 1909, there were several sightings of the creature or its footprints. The description that was given was that it was said to stand 3 to 4 feet high, with a head resembling a horse, and it had bat-like wings. Others said that it was only as big as a dog. Folklorists James McCloy and Ray Miller said in their book, The Jersey Devil, that during the brief scare, most residents stayed behind locked doors, factories and schools closed, and armed posses searched for the creature. One of the first reported sightings occurred to a New Jersey policeman, James Sackville, who was on patrol when he said he spotted a winged beast hopping like a bird and giving off a blood-curdling scream, which then flew into the morning darkness. According to press reports, over 100 people in more than 24 communities saw the devil. A second type of delusion involves community flight panics, where inhabitants attempt to flee an imaginary threat. These episodes typically last a few hours or several days, and then they subside once revealed that the harmful agent didn't materialize. Examples include mass flights from London in response to prophecies of its destruction by a great flood in 1524, or Judgment Day happening in 1736, or an earthquake happening in 1761. The latter episode happened on February 8th, 1761, when a minor earthquake struck London, damaging several chimneys. Another tremor occurred a month later on March 8th, and the coincidence became the subject of widespread discussion. A man named Bell then predicted that London would be destroyed in a third quake on April 5th. British journalist Charles Mackay writes, "As the awful day approached, the excitement became intense, and a great number of credulous people resorted to all the villages within a circle of 20 miles, awaiting the doom of London. People paid exorbitant fees to temporarily board with households in such places as Highgate, Hampstead, Islington, Blackheath, and Harrow. The poor stayed in London until 2 or 3 days before the predicted event, when they left to camp in fields in the countryside. When the time arrived, nothing happened." Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, so that's a broad overview of the psychological processes that can explain mass delusions or mass psychosis or mass hysteria. Let's drill in more deeply to the most infamous of these, which I already mentioned briefly, and that was the Salem witch trials. Now first, let's set the stage for 17th century Puritan culture. For the Puritans, who were a breakaway from the Anglican Church and believed that there didn't need to be a clerical class or a magisterium to act as an intermediary between them and the scripture, they understood scripture. Scripture was practically pumped into the air and water of the New World, and they understood scripture to be a living, breathing thing. If scripture was a word of God and it spoke into their contemporary lives, then why not govern themselves according to it, even passages from the Old Testament? So in 1641, when colonists established a legal code, one of the first capital crimes was idolatry, which stands to reason because it's mentioned in the Ten Commandments, and laws against idolatry are all over the Old Testament Levitical code. The second law was on witchcraft, which is also mentioned in the Old Testament and their laws against it. The code said, "If any man or woman be a witch, that is, has or consults with a familiar spirit, they shall be put to death," which is what the Massachusetts body of laws read. Blasphemy came next, and then murder, poisoning, and bestiality. In the years up to the Salem witch trials, New England indicted more than 100 witches, about a quarter of them men. The first person to be indicted confessed to having entered a pact with Satan. This was a Connecticut servant who'd prayed for help with her chores, and according to the account, an assistant materialized to clear the ashes from the hearth and the hogs from the field. The servant was indicted in 1648 for familiarity with the devil. Well, life in Puritan New England fits the category of what we talked about of communities that could be susceptible to mass hysteria. They were a community that lived in a fragile state. They were inhabiting a new continent, and they constantly had to struggle with American Indian populations. Some were, of course, friendly, but others weren't. One day you might wake up and see four armed Indians appear in your parlor to warm themselves by the fire. You could return from a trip to Boston and find that your house had been burned down and your family taken captive. One Cambridge major general said, "Our men could see no enemy to shoot at." Now let's jump forward to the Salem witch trials. What caused this conflict to erupt at this time? What caused Puritans to think of themselves as engaged at that moment in a battle with the devil and his forces? So this is one of the strangest incidents in early American history. Abram Van Engen's description of the Salem witch trials in the Oxford Research Encyclopedia ascribes mass hysteria to this incident, but also gets into specific social factors that made the Salem witch trials possible. For him, the primary explanations of Salem set the crisis within the context of larger developments in Puritan society. The period at the end of the 17th century was a period of intense economic change, with new markets emerging and new ways of making money. British imperial interests were on the rise also, tightening and growing an empire that had been somewhat loosely held together, and Puritans may have feared that their new religious freedom could be encroached on again. In the midst of these expansions, British colonists and settlers faced numerous wars on the American frontiers, especially in northern New England against French Catholics and their Indian allies. New England also resented shifts in government policy as a result of the changing monarchy in London. Under James II, Massachusetts Bay lost its original charter, which had upheld the Puritan way of life for over 50 years. A new government imposed royal rule and religious tolerance. With the overthrow of James II and the Glorious Revolution, the Massachusetts Bay government carried on with no official charter from 1689 until 1691. When a new charter arrived, right in the middle of the Salem witch hunt, it didn't restore all the privileges or policies of the original New England way. So in other words, in 1692, New England faced economic, political, and religious uncertainty while suffering from several devastating battles on its northern frontier. The threats to this community amplified the fear that was already present, and these factors have all been used to explain the Salem witch trial. When Governor William Phipps finally halted the trials, 19 had been executed, 5 had died in prison, 1 man had been pressed to death for refusing to speak, and very quickly, in a sense, the spell broke and people wondered what on earth had happened. By the time the trials ended, almost everyone agreed that something had gone terribly wrong. But the population couldn't agree on what had gone wrong. Publishing any talk of the trials was prohibited, even though that ban was quickly broken. Since 1695, there have been many interpretations, and American literature has grappled with what happened with the Salem witch trials, and what does it say about the character of early America? Here's what happened in Salem. The events described as witchcraft first began in January 1692. Betty Paris, a minister's 9-year-old daughter, and Abigail Williams, a minister's 11-year-old niece, were the first to be afflicted. As members of the minister's household, this was an embarrassing situation. It suggested that Satan could make his way and afflict anyone's household and possess or demonize beyond a minister's ability to protect or defend. Puritan theology taught that such afflictions came as chastisements from God, which required the minister, Samuel Paris, to examine his ways and repent. Paris didn't suspect witches for many weeks, either because of his embarrassment or because he genuinely repented. He prayed and fasted and waited, and after more than a month of fits in his household, he finally called a doctor. When the doctor pronounced the girls bewitched, it added a new burden. The girls weren't possessed, they were being attacked. But who was bewitching them? Paris's neighbor, Mary Sibley, knew one way to find out. She ordered Paris's slaves, Tituba and John Indian, to bake a witch cake. which was a rye bread mixed with urine from the afflicted children. This was called counter magic or white magic and widely practiced in Puritan New England. Although uniformly condemned by the clergy, since they believed that any form of magic worked only through the power of Satan, the practice of counter magic, trying to use supernatural means to overcome evil with good, continued into the 17th and 18th centuries. Lay people didn't necessarily associate magic with the devil, but just thought that if it healed, it was good magic, and if it harmed, it was bad magic. Apparently, the witch cake worked. When the dog ate it, the children identified their tormentors. However, the same day the witch cake was baked, two more children fell ill. 12-year-old Ann Putnam Jr. and 17-year-old Elizabeth Hubbard, the doctor's maid. The four girls collectively named three witches, and Samuel Parris had good reason to be relieved. Now, he could finally lay the blame elsewhere. Not only were these witches the ones at work, but Sibley's condemned usage of counter magic had done something to summon the devil in Salem. He rebuked Sibley and forced her to confess before the church. Then he used the evidence she procured through counter magic to begin proceedings against the witches. The first suspects were Tituba, a slave from the West Indies, Sarah Good, a poor beggar, and Sarah Osborne, a bedridden widow who scandalized the town by marrying her servant. These early witch hunts were directed at women, and especially at poor, marginalized women, especially those who transgress social norms. Carol Carlson commented that the story of witchcraft is primarily the story of women, especially in its Western incarnation. Witchcraft confronts us with ideas about women, with fears about women, with the place of women in society, and with women itself. It confronts us with systematic violence against women. Now, that might be true at Salem, but in this podcast, I've looked at medieval witchcraft and how women weren't necessarily the recipients of this, and in some places like Finland, men were exclusively blamed for witchcraft, for being warlocks. So the association of charges of witchcraft and violence against women can be true, but I argue that it's not universally true, only if we cherry-pick the data. So Salem began as a limited witch hunt aimed at notorious women. The local magistrates, John Hawthorne, Jonathan Corwin, and Bartholomew Genny, presided over the first phase of examinations. Beginning with Sarah Good, Hawthorne interrogated the defendants in an attempt to force confessions. Questions led with an assumption of guilt. Rather than asking whether Good injured the four children, Hawthorne asked why she did it. Good claimed her innocence, and each denial of guilt evoked a series of fits from the four afflicted girls. Finally, Good accused Osborne, but when the magistrates examined Osborne, much the same occurred. But it was when the court finally heard from Tituba that Salem exploded into an unprecedented affair. Tituba confessed to being a witch under Hawthorne's pressure, and that confession yielded several dramatic results. First, the afflictions of the girls ceased, confirming that confessions were the best way to prevent future harm to the girls and to legitimate the actions of the court. Also, Tituba's confession enabled her to detail the actions of other witches, her supposed accomplices. According to the trusted Puritan theologian William Perkins, a confessed witch who accused others offered valid testimony against them. Tituba explained that Good and Osborne had forced her to harm the girls, and the court believed her. So you see this constant shifting of blame that's going on. Tituba also offered several elements in her confession, all guided by Judge Hawthorne, that became routine in future confessions, mentioning the devil's book, the witches' meetings, descriptions of a black man, satanic masses, and the naming of other suspects. Tituba claimed also that Good and Osborne didn't act alone. She eventually testified to a total of 9 witches, but she couldn't say who they were. Suddenly, a full witch conspiracy was underway, in which Puritan residents of New England thought they were in the middle of a spiritual war. Now there was a quest to unmask these foes. Ann Putnam Jr. took the lead in identifying these other witches. One identified was Dorothy Good, Sarah's 4-year-old daughter. Then, Martha Corey, a member of Samuel Parrish's church, and Rebecca Nurse, a widely respected matriarch and member of the nearby Salem Town Church, and a grandmother in the community. Those who acted as if they were afflicted multiplied. Adults began to suffer fits, including Anne's mother and Tituba's husband, and the fits spread to Mary Warren, the servant of John and Elizabeth Proctor. John Proctor responded by beating her, which seemed to cure her of the problem, and he said that if he were left alone with Tituba's husband, John Indian, he could beat the devil out of him as well. When Mary recovered and returned against the afflicted turned against her. She was accused of witchcraft herself. Before the judges, Mary claimed that the afflicted persons did but dissemble. Fits ensued, and they were so convincing in their performance that Mary reacted with fits of her own to show that she herself was bewitched, and taken back to prison, unable to speak. Mary confessed the next day in court to signing the devil's book, but only because she had been tricked into doing it by the Proctors. Then she accused Giles Corey. She rejoined the ranks of the afflicted and spun out accusations in tandem with them, which saved her own life but cost the lives of many more. These examinations of accused witches continued, but until June, they hadn't been able to proceed to actual trials because the colony lacked an official charter and an ability to try capital offenses. The newly appointed governor, William Phipps, arrived from England in June with a new charter, hearing about the crisis in Salem, and immediately established a court of oyer and terminer, or to hear and determine. Full of high-ranking officials from Boston, the court could move from the initial depositions, testimonials, and examinations to grand jury indictments and final jury trials. The court first tried Bridget Bishop on June 2nd. The trial proceeded quickly, and on June 10th, she was hanged. The Salem witch hunt paused at this point. Accusations and examinations had swept up a series of accused witches, mostly from the vicinity of Salem Village, but now it had executed its first witch, a woman who refused to confess even on the scaffold. Before proceeding, the magistrates wanted some approval from Puritan ministers. Asking their thoughts on the matter, several ministers took 2 days to respond. Their response suggested caution, especially in the use of spectral evidence, or seeing someone's specter or shape harming either oneself or another. The judges at Salem approached spectral evidence in direct violation of precedent and principle. Although the ministers urged caution in this regard, they didn't condemn overtly the proceedings or the judges, and ended by encouraging a vigorous prosecution. So this is what the court wanted to hear. The court pressed on, turning its attention to a second phase of the Salem witch trials to the nearby town of Andover, where a great number of accused quickly confessed. And many of them did so in hopes that this would save their lives with a lesser punishment. In total, at the end of the trials, 19 were executed, one man was pressed to death between boards, and at least 5 died in jail, until Governor Phipps closed down the court of hearing and determination. Phipps created another court to hear the remaining cases, and the second court cleared the jails, refused to accept former confessions, and acquitted all but 3. Governor Phipps immediately reprieved the convicted 3. No one else died for witchcraft in New England after that. All right, so what on earth happened? What are explanations of the Salem witch trial? Van Ingen notes that most scholars agree on the basic narrative of the Salem witch trials. But why it happened is far from clear. What made Salem go so wrong? Scholars have always emphasized the role of religion in the Salem witch hunt, but it wasn't just religion. It was a certain type of religious understanding filtered through extraordinary circumstances taking place. It was sort of a perfect storm. In the book Satan and Salem, Benjamin Ray argues that far from being precipitated by a single key person or circumstances, the Salem crisis was a result of a perfect storm of factors. And this idea of a perfect storm is multiple factors coming together, such as King William's War, economic instability, the lack of a stable government in Salem and no official colony charter, the inexperience of the new governor, the past failings of ruling magistrates, the community feeling threatened by outside forces, and the personalities of Samuel Parris, Thomas Putnam, and many others. Overall, what mattered most, it's what these researchers argue, was that New England Puritans, in the midst of these crises, saw themselves as God's chosen people at war with a newly unleashed and angered Satan. They wanted to win this war, and the most self-assured Puritans became convinced they could win it by purging the land of all those who allied themselves with Satan and Satan's causes. They came to see the devil anywhere, and they sought to defeat him everywhere.
Scott here. One more break for a word from our sponsors.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
Well, one book that has cast a long shadow on how we understood the Salem witch trial and other events of mass hysteria is the 1841 book Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. This book was published by Scottish journalist Charles Mackay in 1841, and he had three sections to the book: national delusions, peculiar follies, and philosophical delusions. It's just about everything we've mentioned so far in this episode, like the dancing mania is mentioned in that book. And the subjects of Mackay's debunking include alchemy, duels, crusades, fortune-telling, holy relics. But then he includes other things like economic bubbles. And a popular quote of his is that men, it has been well said, think in herds. It will be seen that they go mad in herds, while they only recover their senses slowly and one by one. One example of mass psychosis that he gives, which I think is very interesting, is the phenomena of tulip mania. This was an economic bubble, and him likening an economic bubble to the same forces of hysteria as the Salem witch trials or the dancing plague is very interesting. Anyway, here's a little bit about tulip mania, and you can judge for yourself whether this falls under the label of mass hysteria. So tulip mania was a period in the 17th century in which contract prices for tulip bulbs, which had recently been introduced into Europe, reached extraordinary and preposterously high levels and then completely collapsed in February 1637. Tulips were originally from the Ottoman Empire. They weren't native to the Netherlands by any means. And they're attributed to being brought over by Owiger de Busbeck, who was the ambassador of the Holy Roman Empire to the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century. And he sent the first tulip bulbs and seeds to Vienna. Tulip bulbs were then distributed from Vienna to Augsburg, Antwerp, and Amsterdam. And they were very popular. They were brightly colored. These were colors you couldn't see on any other flower. And paint was by no means mass produced in the past like it is today. So seeing a brightly colored building could excite the senses in a way it doesn't now, and imagine what thousands of these flowers being planted could do. The tulip was different from any other known flower to Europe at this time. It had an intense petal color that no other plant had. And the tulip came to the Netherlands right at the time that the Netherlands became a trade empire. It wasn't under the control of Spain any longer, and its resources could be channeled to commerce and trade and the growth of its merchant shipping fleet. So during this time, tulips became a coveted luxury item, and many varieties followed. So by 1634, as a result of foreign demand, speculators entered the market, and this is where the bubble begins to grow. The contract price of bulbs continued to rise throughout 1636, and so did the price of common unbroken bulbs, so that any tulip bulb could fetch hundreds of guilders. In that year, the Dutch created a futures market where contracts to buy bulbs at the end of the season were bought and sold. Traders met in taverns, and buyers had to pay a 2.5% fee up to a maximum of 3 guilders per trade. The Dutch described tulip contract trading as wind trade because no bulbs were actually changing hands. By 1636, the tulip bulb became the fourth leading export product of the Netherlands. The price of tulips skyrocketed because of speculation in tulip futures among people who never saw the bulbs. In the winter of 1636 and 1637 was the height of the bubble, when subbulbs were reportedly changing hands 10 times a day, but no deliveries were ever made to fulfill any of these contracts. In February 1637, tulip bulb contract prices collapsed and the trade of bulbs ground to a halt. The collapse began when, for the first time, buyers apparently refused to show up at a routine bulb auction. Very quickly, the bubble bursts, and it's as if people woke up from their mass hysteria. Well, I want to close off this episode with some consideration of what is the lure of mass delusions? What's the psychological explanation for why we see these events show up so much, not just in history, but continually in the modern era? Robert Bartholomew argues in his book that collective delusions have a powerful seductive lure that change in a chameleon-like fashion to confirm our deepest fears or realize our greatest desires. Most people in the modern world can laugh at witch hunts or belief in the supernatural, but polls suggest that many of these same people likely believe in the reality of flying saucers or ghosts or psychic phenomena. Circumstances regarding people reporting on the New Jersey Devil or UFOs are almost identical to the London earthquake panic of 1761. Modern-day fears of satanic cults resemble the persecution of various deviants and ethnic groups during medieval European witch hunts. And the tulip bubble, you can argue, has a lot of similarities to the housing bubble only 10 years earlier. So this is one event where I don't like the cliche, history repeats itself, but history rhymes. Of mass hysteria, you can see history rhyming. Well, that's all for this episode. Bill, thank you for the question. And if any of you have a question for me about history, you're always free to contact me. And if you want to absolutely guarantee that I will answer it, you're more than welcome to join the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. All right, well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. All right, that is all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes for this and all my other episodes and include sources, maps, or other relevant information, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. Parthenon is the name of the podcast network that History Unplugged is a part of, along with other great history shows like James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. This really helps the show grow. The second thing is to join our membership program on Patreon. And if you do so, you can get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog of the show, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening and see you next time.